Welcome to Come Inside. Today's guest is Dr. Jane Loney. She's a Sydney-based clinical neuropsychologist with over 20 years' experience. This was a really important conversation that needed to be had. We know now, more than ever, how important nutrition is for brain development. And although we touch on a lot of different subjects within brain health, this conversation doesn't just relate to inmates. Yes, we need to do more in the sense of juvenile inmates need to be getting more nutritious food. So we need to do better because it's bad for them. It's bad for their brain health. It's bad for their development. But it does start in the home. Children need to be given and taught about nutrition. Adults need to take better care of themselves. And it's something that I myself am guilty of. I didn't grow up with understanding anything about nutrition at all. I now get my knowledge of how important nutrition is from people like my sister and my brother-in-law. And I have friends that are, you know, really good at all that kind of stuff. You know, so it is something that I'm still learning. This is one of the shorter conversations, but it touches on a lot of topics. And there's so much information there that I think you will take something away from it. The brain is fascinating, but Dr. Jane Loney is also fascinating. Her story, you know, she touches on it a little bit here and talks about what she has been through. And I think that it says a lot about her because I think what she has been through probably has made her extremely empathetic. And I think that that's a really amazing quality. But for now, I hope you enjoy this conversation. And if you want to know more about Dr. Jane Loney, I will put the link to her website in the description of the episode. Enjoy.
All right, so where I want to start was at your childhood. What was it like? And if there was really more specifically, was there something that made you want to become a clinical neuropsychologist?
Okay, my childhood, not a lot to report interest-wise in my, it was pretty standard childhood, I think. Nothing unusual, lucky to have a wonderful family, lovely parents, worked really hard. And so nothing absolutely. Look, I did have some health problems in my later school years around an eating disorder and ended up, you know, having sort of hospital treatment for that. And I think probably, and some depression, and I think that probably alerted me and got me really interested in psychology and mental health. I wasn't really sure, as I think as most people are when they leave school, what they want to do. So I just went into a fairly general degree, but it became quite apparent very early on that I was very interested in the medical and science aspect of psychology and mental health, and clinical neuropsychology really, I suppose, ticked those boxes for me.
Do you think that's because what you went through?
I think probably that drew me to psychology, and I think probably just, I mean, I was always a detail person and very sort of scientific in my approach, so that probably then drew me to the more sort of science, medical side of psychology, I think.
Can you explain what you do as a clinical neuropsychologist?
Sure. So one of the really good things about clinical neuropsychology, and I suppose, I mean, to some extent other areas of work, is that you can actually operate in a number of different fields at the same time. So from my perspective, what that means is that I'm involved in academic writing. So I'll write in the area of legal capacity and dementia. I do clinical work. So and predominantly, again, that's in the area of neurodegenerative diseases, so early stage dementia, but also, you know, adult causes of cognitive difficulties like motor vehicle accidents and some, you know, psychiatric disorders. So there's the clinical side and then medico-legal side as well. So sometimes, for example, in an insurance situation, the courts and the insurers need to know the extent and the nature of somebody's injury, brain injury, and how that's going to impact on their future and current function. Sometimes in a forensic setting, the accused's mental state and particularly cognitive state comes into sentencing. And sometimes, particularly in the population that I deal with, I see patients where there's a question about their ability, or their legal term is legal capacity, to sign a document. So, for example, to transfer transfer their house into their son or daughter's or neighbour's name, or to rewrite a will, or so on and so forth. So there's a few different elements, I suppose, to how you can apply your knowledge, which I find really interesting.
That's, yeah, quite a wide range of things, which I guess would keep things quite interesting, but it seems quite intense.
Oh, look, it is. It's intense in different ways. So yep. Not a lot of room for error when you're writing medical legal reports, particularly if you're going to have to be in the stand yes. and be ripped apart. You don't want to sort of, and really, I think as well, in a clinical sense, for me, particularly when I'm seeing, you know, patients and often their families of somebody sort of with early dementia, I'm often involved in the stage where, you know, that diagnosis is being made and is being communicated to patients and their families. So that's obviously fairly intense and on a, you know, in a different way.
Have you been on the stand much?
Not a lot. I have.
Yep.
Certainly in one criminal trial and in a number of civil cases around capacity. Thankfully, most settle before
okay.
they go to court.
Yes.
however, you know, some don't. In a civil arena, that the ones that don't tend to involve large sums of money and disputed wills.
So, is that nerve-wracking?
Look, it really depends how well you've prepared your report. And whenever I write a medico-legal report, whether it's criminal or civil, I have that front of mind. I sit down and assume that I am going to be cross-examined. So I think if you can prepare your report with that in mind, you usually feel pretty good. And you don't feel too nervous when
okay.
you are.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
How do you put together your report? Do you sit down and interview the person you're writing it about? Do you look at their medical history? How does that work?
So that's a good question. And I remember actually in very early stages of teaching, we were taught the difference between neuropsychological assessment and neuropsychological testing, which probably most people, you know, would just use interchangeably. But look, the testing that we do is a part of a wider assessment. And as you mentioned, the wider assessment does involve interview and observation and access to other relevant related medical information, medical files, and so on and so forth.
So I'm wondering, what do you do to not be consumed by your job?
I probably don't have a healthy balance.
Oh, you don't?
Probably not. But in a way, I think that's because I am genuinely interested in the work I do. So that
yeah,
line
okay.
between work and passion and interest and wanting to get it right and wanting to make a difference is blurred. Having said that, I will go mad if I don't get to run. It just really kind of balances things out mentally for me. So it puts things back in perspective and just it's like a refresh button to me. So that's good.
If we go more down the path of criminals, I wanted to know if you think if they know the difference between empathy and sympathy. I find those terms are quite interchangeable and maybe a lot of society don't really know the difference.
So, look, I think you couldn't possibly make a general statement
no,
in terms of criminals overall. But just a couple of points, and again, this is obviously from a neuropsychological perspective. There are a number of studies now that show us that a very high proportion of inmates have some degree of cognitive impairment or intellectual disability. And when we're talking about empathy and indeed sympathy, one of the really, really important areas of their cognition to consider is something that we call social cognition. So what I mean by social cognition is exactly that, the ability to empathize with others, the ability to appreciate how your actions are going to affect somebody else's life. So another word that we use for that type of cognitive function is theory of mind. So is a person able to, I suppose, assume the position or stand in the shoes of somebody else? And, you know, I think for a lot of people who are not overly familiar with neuroscience, which is probably most people, fair enough, we would maybe think that, you know, that's something that's purely taught, that's something that we observe, hopefully through our parents, and we learn is, you know, how to behave. But it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. And we know now from diseases like some of the dementias, particularly those that affect the front part of the brain first, that there are certain brain networks that are designated to those functions that allow people to see things from the perspective of other people and empathize. And we know that when those parts of the brain or those brain networks are damaged, that people lose the ability to do that. So it's not just about, well, you know, maybe they were not brought up very well, or maybe they haven't been taught that, we know that there are networks that allow people to empathise. So when we know that there's a huge percentage of the prison population with brain impairment, that's an important thing to consider.
In regards to brain impairment, I mean, obviously there's probably a lot of different reasons someone would have that type of impairment. Could it be like they were born with it?
Yeah.
Maybe they had a brain injury, maybe they were beaten, or if you're in a car accident or something, I'm sure that's the same. But would it manifest in a different way?
Yeah, look, yes. So depending on which networks are affected, the symptoms of that brain impairment or the problems that they cause for the person in terms of thinking abilities and functioning will vary. But yes, that there can be problems with brain function from birth in childhood developmental disorders, but there can also be what you referred to as, for example, a hit to the head or a closed head injury or a motor vehicle accident. We would call that an acquired brain injury. So something that you're not necessarily born with, but you acquire from some sort of insult to the brain, you know, at some point post-birth.
Is there any recovering from that? Sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. Look, it depends. Developmentally, when things can, I suppose, become magnified at a certain stage of development, depending on what skills that child's acquiring, and then can sort of settle down as the child's learned to sort of manage things later on. In terms of acquired brain injury, if we take, for example, a motor vehicle accident, we would expect to see 18 months post-incident, most of the spontaneous recovery that is going to occur would have occurred.
Oh, really? In that 18 months?
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that, you know, rehab and, you know, other strategies can't be put in place to help manage the symptoms, but the brain can reorganize and repair to some degree. So most of that would have occurred within an 18-month period.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't know there was an 18-month period there. Do you have a theory on or a belief as to why people would commit crimes? I'm talking really heinous crimes. Murder, rape, cannibalism. Do you think it's got to do with the brain? Is there something not right? I mean, obviously something's not right.
Yeah, look, yeah. I think the possibilities are just so varied. And I imagine that in most cases, there are a number of factors that are present. The stats in terms of the prison population suggest that in a number of those cases, at least, there may be some underlying cognitive disability or impairment. Right. The other key aspect of cognition in terms of crime to think about is something that we refer to as impulsivity. So again, when certain, particularly frontal networks of the brain, orbitofrontal networks are affected, we lose our ability to inhibit or hold back a behaviour that's perhaps not desirable or perhaps harmful or perhaps socially unacceptable. So when that inhibition mechanism is damaged, people can behave in a very impulsive way. So, you know, you can, I'm sure, appreciate what that means if we're thinking about, you know, crimes of passion, for example.
Yes. Okay. Do you think that rehabilitation, do you believe in it for criminals, for inmates, whether or not they're going to be let out of prison, maybe they're on death row, whatever it is? Obviously, we can't generalise and say everyone can be rehabilitated, but do you think it's possible for some?
I have no doubt it's possible for some. It's not an area that I've worked in, but intuitively what I would say is that, you know, there's going to, in all likelihood, be a mix of circumstance, upbringing, you know, the social environment, maybe cognitive function, maybe emotional control regulation, a whole variety of factors that have potentially led to that person being in the situation that they're in and having, you know, committed whatever crime. I think probably understanding the factors that are important for each particular individual, I would imagine, would help you to predict the likelihood of successful rehabilitation.
I did want to ask you, I know we don't have the death penalty here in Australia. I want to know what your thoughts are, if you think it's a deterrent, given how many people are currently on death row.
Yeah, look, again, I mean, I think it probably could act as a deterrent in certain cases, but I think it would depend on, again, the factors that are at play for that individual in terms of feeding into the criminal act, and also what type of act it was. You know, if you're dealing with somebody with limited scope to control their impulses, limited ability to appreciate, you know, the consequences of their actions on somebody else, limited ability to, you know, think ahead in time and reason, then potentially it won't have any bearing on their actions.
Whereas
if you're dealing with somebody who's involved in crime for a different sort of a wider self-benefit purpose, then potentially something that would come into their mind.
I think I was reading something very recently, a statistic on the US, you know, they've got quite a lot of people on death row there. There was only about 12% of the population on death row have graduated high school.
So, I mean, I think that statistic's interesting on two levels. I mean, obviously you've got fairly low levels of education among most of those people. But for me, it also then is a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Well, why is it that those people are so poorly educated? And there are a number of reasons that could be, obviously social, but it's also possible that some cognitive problems from birth or acquired at an early age have led to them being unable to remain in education. So it's a little bit difficult to know.
Okay. Yeah, it's hard if there's not like a single case we're looking at where we can completely look into every aspect of them.
Yeah, and there's going to be a whole lot of reasons why, you know, the other 78% are not, you know, why they're very poorly educated, have very low levels of education. And I imagine, as I say, sometimes it'll be, you know, their social situation, and other times there may be pre-existing emotional cognitive problems that prevented them from remaining in education.
Okay. I'm sure it is illegal to actually execute someone who doesn't understand what's happening. Like, if they don't have all their mental faculties, but they have often executed people probably all over the world. But I know in America there was a case, I think her name was Wanda Jean. She had no idea what was going on, and they executed her. And according to her lawyer, she didn't know where they were taking her, what they were doing with her.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting area of law for me, because this is where a lot of the work that I do in the area of capacity is what you're referring to, but in a criminal context comes in. So one of the big issues with the judicial system at the moment is they're having a lot of difficulty grasping between fairly low-level concepts of understanding and communicating, and then higher level, what we call executive functions of appreciating and judging. So sometimes a test for legal capacity will say, well, do they understand the nature and effect of a document? And that's a pretty low-level threshold. Most people, you know, even people that can't necessarily read or write, if you explain something, you know, verbally, they can understand that. But when we come to appreciating the consequences, it's a little bit more sophisticated and a little bit more complex. And I think sometimes determinations of legal capacity, whether it be in a criminal or a civil setting, don't adequately take into account the requirement for those higher level executive functions to be intact.
Do you think that's because they don't know?
Yeah, they're neuropsychological, neuroscientific concepts. They're abstract concepts. As I say, most people don't know that there are brain networks for those abilities. So just a lack of awareness and understanding.
Do you think, in regards to the brain, for mental illness, for example, there's a lot of different drugs out there that you can take. Mm-hmm. Do you think if, say, someone's not taking their medication, they go and kill someone? If they were taking their medication, and again, I know it's very difficult to generalise, but if they are, would that stop that urge?
Look, I think it could potentially, in some cases, it could play a very important role in preventing crime. And I mean, again, I'm just generalising, but if we take the condition of schizophrenia, for example, we know that one of the primary symptoms is what they call paranoid delusions, which means thoughts that are not based in reality, but somebody is trying to harm them, for example. Now, part of the sort of role for the medication, in this case, an antipsychotic medication, would be to, I suppose, minimise or keep those psychotic delusions in check. So, you know, I don't need to explain to you how that could, I suppose, motivate somebody to harm somebody else if they were unmedicated. Yeah.
Do you think there's anything that would help or deter people away from a life of crime?
From a very neuropsychological angle, I really think there needs to be a greater appreciation of the levels of cognitive disability and cognitive limitations in people who do become involved in criminal activity. And I mean that whether we're talking about young children, whether we're talking about adults, or whether we're talking about there's an emerging literature looking at early stages of dementia, particularly dementia affecting the frontal lobe, and cases where there's been very uncharacteristic criminal activity as a manifesting sign of those brain changes. So if we can really acknowledge that and better identify and accommodate and support those cognitive difficulties early on, I would hope and I would expect that that would have an impact on crime rates.
Okay. Do you think that we need to be doing more maybe at a lower level, in the sense of maybe in schools? Like, they need to be taught about the brain a bit more, or I know that's maybe a bit hard and difficult.
I think brain health might be a good start. I mean, we do in school learn about nutrition and body health and how to look after ourselves and road safety. So I think it would be fair to say that in the grand scheme of our body, the brain is pretty important. I mean, all of our functions are important, but the brain is particularly important. So, I think there probably is scope for some more, you know, low-level education around what can go wrong and how to protect yourself from that and how to support people who have brain changes and how it can affect their behaviour as well.
Okay, yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. You've mentioned dementia quite a bit. When I think of the word dementia, and this is because I don't have a great understanding of the brain, certainly not to your level, of course. When I hear the word dementia, I think of an older person all of a sudden just forgetting things. But it starts earlier, doesn't it?
Sad to say, but there are patients who develop dementia in their 30s. There's a sort of a class of dementias that we call early onset dementias, and they tend to hit around 50s, early 50s. And those presentations are often more focal, meaning that they present with for example, a visual problem as a presenting symptom or affect the frontal lobe. The other key thing, three things, so that would be my first point. The second point would be dementia is really the umbrella term for progressive loss of cognitive function. But underneath that umbrella, there are many, many, many types of dementia. So Alzheimer's is the most common one, and that's why people usually associate dementia with memory loss, because that's the primary symptom in Alzheimer's. But memory loss is certainly not the primary symptom in a lot of other types of dementia. The only other thing that I would emphasise is that, you know, you mentioned when I think of dementia, I think of somebody suddenly, and that word sticks in my mind, having memory problems. Well, in fact, we know now that those changes in the brain that are occurring at that cellular level in the brain begin and accumulate up to 20 years before the first symptom becomes apparent. So,
wow.
These
really?
These changes,
20 years?
Absolutely. So these changes are happening at the cellular level for decades, and they are, in terms of symptom level, they emerge very, very gradually and slowly over time. So not a sudden thing. We might suddenly notice because our grandma or grandpa can't do something that they were able to do before, but that's not because it's suddenly changed. That's just because it's reached a certain threshold that doesn't then allow them to perform that function. So not sudden, and they're very progressive changes over many, many years.
Is there anything that we can do to prevent getting dementia? Do we have to keep our brain active?
There's limited. I mean, there's some evidence looking at the benefits of exercise. There's evidence looking at the importance of sleep. Obviously, our health generally, insofar as it relates to minimising what we call our vascular risk factors. So what I mean by keeping your blood pressure in check, not smoking, avoiding things like heart disease, diabetes, these sorts of things that affect our cardiovascular system. So, there are a number of things that we can do to reduce our chances. Unfortunately, it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen, even if we do all those things well. So,
I didn't realise it could start 20 years beforehand. Because it does, I mean, poor choice of words on my behalf, but it does seem sudden, even though it's not sudden.
It does. That's right. But normally there's a lot more sort of subtle changes that have actually been going on that grandpa's been getting by or masking or getting help with or whatever for a number of years prior to that point.
And do you think maybe GPs don't know what those sudden changes are, so it's kind of hard to be like, oh, maybe this is starting?
GPs are okay when the wheels fall off. Typically, most GPs will then be alerted to the fact that, you know, there's cognitively something wrong, and that's why the person's not functioning. But typically not very good at recognising the changes over the sort of 5 to 10 years prior to that.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate you giving me so much of your time.
Not at all. Good luck, okay?
Thank you very much. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out. Class dismissed.